From New York, this is Democracy Now!
But in Idlib, nowhere is safe. Almost 50,000 are sheltering under trees or in other open spaces. I am getting daily reports of babies and other young children dying in the cold. Imagine the grief of a parent who escaped a war zone with their child, only to watch that child freeze to death.
As the humanitarian catastrophe in Syria deepens, aid workers describe scenes of chaos and devastation, with families scrambling for shelter as temperatures fall below freezing and children freeze to death. We'll get an update on Idlib from Avril Benoit, Executive Director of MSF USA, Doctors Without Borders. We'll also talk about coronavirus and talk about their new report called No Way Out, on how immigration policies imposed by the U.S. and Mexico trap thousands of Central American migrants in dangerous conditions.
I've lived a very difficult life of violence. I have been mistreated and forced to sell drugs. I have very bad memories because I already have two dead brothers for the same reason, because they didn't want to be involved
then
in that.
Then to the Dominican Republic, where thousands took to the streets of the capital, Santo Domingo, Thursday, to protest the abrupt suspension of local elections.
We want to know what happened with the suspension of the municipal elections. We want answers. Young people are 40% of voters this year, and we deserve justice, as we have demanded in recent days.
And we look at the fight to save a New Jersey elementary school from the healthcare industry and gentrification. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. California Governor Gavin Newsom said Thursday 33 people in California have tested positive for coronavirus and that officials are monitoring 8,400 other people for possible exposure. Newsom's warning came after health officials in Northern California identified the first U.S. case of coronavirus found in a person who had not had known contact with anyone else with coronavirus, raising fears the pathogen is spreading among the general public for the first time in the U.S.
We knew this was inevitable as it relates to the nature, the epidemiology, the nature of these viruses, that that incident would occur.
California's warning came as a whistleblower complained the Department of Health and Human Services sent more than a dozen workers to receive the first Americans evacuated from Wuhan, China, without proper training for infection control or appropriate protective gear. Those workers were then reportedly not tested for the virus. Across the U.S., officials are reporting a severe shortage of test kits for the virus. New York officials say they're preparing their own kits after kits distributed by the Centers for Disease Control failed validation tests. Meanwhile, new cases of coronavirus continue to spring up worldwide, with Nigeria reporting its first case and one of Iran's vice presidents testing positive. At the Vatican, Pope Francis canceled a planned mass after he became ill from an unknown ailment, raising jitters in Italy, where 17 people have died of coronavirus. Fears over the virus have hammered stock markets worldwide, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropping nearly 1,200 points Thursday, the single largest point drop in its history. In Syria, 33 Turkish soldiers were killed Thursday in an airstrike by Russian-backed Syrian forces in rebel-held Idlib province in a major escalation in the all-out offensive by Bashar al-Assad's regime. Turkey vowed to respond in kind as U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an immediate ceasefire, saying, quote, "the risk of even greater escalation grows by the hour." Fighting in Idlib has displaced some 900,000 people since December. Many children have frozen to death in dire conditions. This is UNICEF's Executive Director Henrietta Fore, who testified Thursday to the UN Security Council.
Tens of thousands are now living in makeshift tents in public buildings, in open air, huddled under trees, exposed to rain and snow in sub-zero cold of the harsh Syrian winter. The recent strikes on these makeshift camps in Idlib and on the children and teachers horrifically killed just 2 days ago as 10 schools were attacked, are both reprehensible and morally repugnant. Also, these acts clearly demonstrate the terrifying daily conditions of those living through this nightmare.
We'll have more on the humanitarian catastrophe in Syria after headlines. We'll speak with the head of Doctors Without Borders USA. Immigrant rights groups are expressing outrage after the Trump administration said Wednesday it's creating a task force to strip the citizenship of naturalized Americans who were born abroad. Critics say the Justice Department's so-called denaturalization section is likely unconstitutional. The immigrant rights group CIRLA said in response, quote, Trump is weaponizing the DOJ to make naturalized immigrants look like second-class citizens. Former Vice President Joe Biden is continuing to campaign in South Carolina today ahead of Saturday's presidential primary. This week, Biden picked up the endorsement of Democratic House Whip Jim Clyburn, South Carolina's most prominent African-American lawmaker. Clyburn's endorsement came as Biden's campaign admitted that then-Senator Biden was not arrested in South Africa during a congressional delegation trip in the 1970s, as Biden falsely claimed from the campaign trail at least three times this month. Biden first made the claim in 2013, saying he, quote, had the great honor of being arrested with our U.N. ambassador on the streets of Soweto, unquote, as they tried to reach Mandela in his prison on Robben Island. Robben Island is over 750 miles from the township of Soweto. Biden's campaign now says he was separated from his black colleagues at the airport in Johannesburg. Meanwhile, frontrunner Bernie Sanders held a massive rally Thursday morning in Spartanburg, South Carolina, where he called his campaign a movement that cannot be stopped.
It is a movement for economic justice, for social justice, for racial justice, for environmental justice. And when millions of people stand up and fight back, nothing on earth can stop us.
Senator Sanders went on to a rally at Winston-Salem State University in North Carolina, where he led a march of hundreds of students to an early voting site. Later Thursday, thousands of Sanders supporters packed a rally in Richmond, Virginia, another Super Tuesday state. Sanders' surging popularity comes as the New York Times interviewed dozens of Democratic establishment leaders who will serve as superdelegates at the party's nominating convention in July and found the vast majority are so opposed to Sanders' candidacy, they're willing to risk damage to the Democratic Party. Of 93 superdelegates surveyed by the Times, nearly all said they would vote against Sanders in a brokered convention if Sanders were to arrive with a plurality and not a majority of pledged delegates. Many of the superdelegates are corporate lobbyists with health care clients opposing Sanders' Medicare for All legislation. The Intercept's Lee Fong reports one of them, Democratic National Committee member William Owen, donated exclusively to Republican Senate candidates during the last election cycle, including an $8,500 contribution to a joint fundraising committee designed to benefit Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Owen is backing former Vice President Joe Biden for the Democratic nomination in 2020. Billionaire presidential hopeful former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg refused to apologize Thursday for his oversight of a secret New York Police Department intelligence program that targeted Muslim communities. For years, the NYPD's so-called demographics unit secretly infiltrated Muslim student groups, sent informants into mosques, eavesdropped on conversations in restaurants, barbershops, and gyms, and built a vast database of information. The program was established with help from the CIA, even though the agency is barred from domestic spying. The former head of the NYPD's intelligence division testified in 2012 that the Muslim surveillance program failed to yield a single criminal lead. This is Mayor Bloomberg speaking to Judy Woodruff of PBS's NewsHour.
You're talking about right after 9/11, when everybody was petrified about another terrorist attack. We were super careful to always obey the law. Number one, it's the right thing to do. And number two, you knew people would be looking at it. We sent some officers into some mosques to listen to the sermon that the imam gave. The courts ruled it was exactly within the law, and that's the kind of thing we should be doing.
Arab American Institute Executive Director Maya Berry wrote in response, quote, as Mayor Michael Bloomberg surveilled where American Muslims ate, socialized, gathered, prayed, and studied. The NYPD literally mapped our communities across three states, causing systemic self-censoring, distrust of any interaction with the government, and untold harm to our communities, Maya Berry wrote. Meanwhile, a newly resurfaced audio tape from 2009 captured then-Mayor Bloomberg comparing Social Security to the investment company of Wall Street fraudster Bernie Madoff.
Social Security. It's a Ponzi scheme. I don't know if Bernie Madoff got his idea from there, but if there's ever a Ponzi scheme, people say Madoff was the biggest wrong. Social Security is far and away.
Then-Mayor Bloomberg made the comment in 2009 on his radio program live from City Hall, where he repeatedly called for cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Meanwhile, ProPublica reports Michael Bloomberg met in 2017 with Mortimer Sackler, son of a co-founder of OxyContin producer Purdue Pharma, to discuss ways the billionaire Sackler family could combat growing outrage over the company's role in the opioid crisis. Bloomberg reportedly steered the family to a crisis communications specialist who had been his mayoral press secretary. In Georgia, newly surfaced emails show then-Secretary of State Brian Kemp mocked reports of voter suppression during the 2018 gubernatorial race. Kemp is a Republican who went on to narrowly win the election over Stacey Abrams for governor, who was vying to become the first Black woman governor in the United States. The race was marred by widespread allegations of voter suppression carried out by Kemp. In one email, Kemp used a laughing from crying emoji to reply to a press release by a lawmaker who warned Georgia had canceled a 500,000 voter registrations in a purge that systematically targeted Democrats. In another email, Kemp praised campaign officials for blunting an article on voter suppression in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, writing, quote, good work. This story is so complex, folks will not make it all the way through it. The Veterans Administration's Inspector General is probing allegations the VA Secretary Robert Wilkie sought damaging information to smear the reputation of a senior Veterans Affairs policy advisor after she reported she was sexually assaulted at a VA hospital in Washington, D.C. Andrea Goldstein, a staff member of the Women Veterans Task Force of the House Veterans Committee, reported last September that a man slammed her below the waist and pressed his body against hers as she tried to buy a snack at the medical center's cafeteria. At the time of the alleged assault, Goldstein had just come from Capitol Hill, where she was working on a bill designed to curb sexual assault and harassment. In January, VA Secretary Wilkie called the sexual assault claims unsubstantiated in a letter to Goldstein's boss. Goldstein responded in an op-ed, writing on the website Jezebel, quote, he used coded language, but the words still stung. The secretary of the second largest federal agency knew his words would resonate. He was implying that I was a liar, Goldstein wrote. Meanwhile, a federal investigation has concluded that the University of Southern California mishandled dozens of reports of sexual assaults by Student Health Center gynecologist Dr. George Tyndall, which may have allowed the abuse to continue for decades. Over 400 survivors say Dr. Tyndall raped or forcibly touched them and made racist and misogynistic comments while he sexually abused them. In Colombia, 51-year-old social leader Cristobal Anaya Gonzalez was found dead with a gunshot to the head on Monday, 4 days after he disappeared in rural area in Colombia's Santander region. Anaya Gonzalez was co-founder of an organization that serves victims of anti-personnel landmines in eastern Colombia. This week, the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights reported there were 108 murders of human rights defenders in Colombia last year, including 15 women and 2 members of the LGBTQ community. That was nearly 50% rise from 2018, and so far this year, more than 50 social leaders have been murdered. In Costa Rica, 45-year-old land defender Yeri Rivera of the Buran indigenous community was murdered Monday by an armed mob after he joined a campaign by indigenous families to reoccupy their ancestral lands. It was the second murder of an indigenous land defender in the past year. Under a law passed in 1977, Costa Rica's 24 legally recognized indigenous groups are entitled to reclaim lands taken from their ancestors, but the law has never been implemented. In Mexico, one of the men who participated in the murder of award-winning morning journalist Javier Valdez was sentenced Thursday to nearly 15 years in prison. Heriberto Picos Barraza served as a getaway driver for two other men who are charged with dragging Valdez from his car and shooting him 12 times. The murder in May 2017 came less than a block from the office of Riodoche, the newspaper Valdez co-founded in the Mexican state of Sinaloa. And in California, hundreds of unionized graduate student workers at the University of California, Santa Barbara, walked out of classes onto picket lines Thursday to demand a COLA, or cost of living adjustment. The grad students who work as teachers' assistants say they're severely burdened by high rents and low wages. Meanwhile, grad student workers at UC Davis say they'll refuse to submit grades unless administrators agree to a monthly housing stipend to help offset skyrocketing rents in Davis. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. We begin today in Syria, where 33 Turkish soldiers stationed in the rebel-held Idlib province were killed in an airstrike by Russian-backed Syrian forces on Thursday. It's a major escalation in the all-out offensive by Bashar al-Assad's regime and its Russian allies that has displaced some 900,000 people from northwestern Syria since December. Turkey, which has long backed rebel forces in Syria, has vowed to respond in kind, as UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres calls for an immediate ceasefire, saying, quote, "the risk of even greater escalation grows by the hour." Russian President Vladimir Putin and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan reportedly spoke by phone on Friday to discuss the crisis as NATO urged rapid de-escalation. This comes as Turkey has temporarily opened its border for fleeing Syrian refugees to cross through the country to Europe.
Of the nearly 1 million people displaced from Syria since December alone, at least half of them are children. It's the single largest displacement in a 9-year war that's forced 13 million to flee, left hundreds of thousands dead. As a humanitarian catastrophe deepens, aid workers are describing scenes of chaos and devastation on the ground, with hundreds of thousands of families scrambling for shelter as temperatures fall below freezing. Children have frozen to death in the dire conditions. All the while, bombs continue to fall. On Tuesday, the Syrian regime bombed 8 school facilities, killing 21 people, according to aid workers. This is UNICEF's executive director, Henrietta Fore.
Tens of thousands are now living in makeshift tents and public buildings, in open air, huddled under trees, exposed to rain and snow and sub-zero cold of the harsh Syrian winter. The recent strikes on these makeshift camps in Idlib and on the children and teachers horrifically killed just 2 days ago as 10 schools were attacked are both reprehensible and morally repugnant. Also, these acts clearly demonstrate the terrifying daily conditions of those living through this nightmare. And we've heard and read reports of children freezing to death. When wood runs out, families burn whatever they can find. Plastic bags, garbage, discarded furniture, just to provide a flicker of heat against the cold, or a simple fire to cook whatever food they can find. In these informal settlements, children and women are at particular risk of violence and exploitation. Makeshift toilets offer no safety or privacy. Landmines and improvised explosive devices dot the landscape. Every step people take is a risk. In the Northwest, 280,000 children have had their education cruelly snatched away. An estimated 180 schools are out of operation, destroyed, damaged, or being used for shelters. Another blow to children's hopes and futures. Access to health care is almost non-existent or financially out of reach. Hospitals continue to be targeted. 72 have suspended services because of the fighting.
That's UNICEF's executive director, Henrietta Fore, addressing the UN Security Council yesterday. Well, for more, we're joined here in New York by our guest, Avril Benoit. She's executive director of Médecins Sans Frontières USA. That's MSF, or Doctors Without Borders USA. Welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about the crisis in Syria. 900,000 people. Talk about the scope of this.
The scope is unprecedented, certainly for Idlib. That whole area was considered a kind of safe zone. People who had been relocated because of the retaking of territory and different movements of people, many of them had ended up in this Idlib area. It was so it was, yes, controlled by opposition armed groups. We were trying to support hospitals there. What we found in the last couple of days, of course, is that they've been subjected to aerial bombardment, to shelling, to ground forces. It has been catastrophic. From a humanitarian perspective, you know, you've got the displacement of people, which you heard about. In our own hospitals that we support, which are run by very brave, very courageous Syrian medical teams, they were dealing with an influx, a mass casualty group of people with very severe injuries, conducting 30 operations, surgical operations in a day, 185 patients coming in. 18 of them arrived and were declared dead upon arrival, a lot of children. And these surgeries, even, you know, just to focus on the medical piece, these are complex surgeries. You know, you've got people whose limbs have been amputated as buildings have collapsed on them. And the stocks, the supplies of anesthesia for those surgeons has been desperately low. And so you can imagine the horror of being a medical physician, of being a medical personnel trying to alleviate the suffering of people, that you're trying to heal them and repair their wounds and their excruciating pain. Meanwhile, you're working and you hear the shelling, you hear the bombing, you hear the screaming, you hear people experiencing panic attacks all around you because, I mean, it's absolutely frightening. So then you've got what's happening on the outside of these hospital facilities where people are fleeing en masse. And so this is where we see that for this Idlib region, it's an unprecedented catastrophe. And even when you look at the history, 9 years of war in Syria, we have seen horrific things go on. And if, you know, no one can say that this is the end game or that it's going to end anytime soon. But certainly it's absolutely shocking, even to those who have been used to it, if you will. The humanitarian organizations, the Syrian doctors, all these people that have been focused on you, even the journalists who've been watching this space, are absolutely shocked by the suffering going on right now.
Well, I wanted to ask you about all of the groups that are involved in fighting, because obviously Turkey has moved into the Idlib province. The Syrians, backed by the Russians, there are still guerrilla groups that had been in opposition for a while. What about the issue of all of these outside groups coming in and using this territory to conduct these wars, because it's the civilian population that suffers?
They do suffer. And you can imagine that when we're talking about maybe 3 million people living in a zone, they're not all part of these combatants, you know, these various groups. They are not legitimate targets under international humanitarian law. It's mostly civilians living there. So, yes, there's all kinds of proxy war activities, different splinter groups, different factions and allegiances. There's no question, though, that under international humanitarian law, indiscriminate bombing is not allowed. We're talking about bombings of schools which had maybe been turned into shelters for families. Most of the people that are on the run, as is often the case when there's a mass displacement of people in the context of war, are women and children. You cannot say that they were active combatants, and you cannot say that it's legitimate at all to raise or try to raise the places where they were trying to survive.
Of the nearly 1 million people displaced from Syria just since December, at least half are children. I want to turn to Jenna, a 10-year-old Syrian child who was displaced by the Russian-backed Syrian government offensive against Idlib.
I felt sadness. I lived in Marat and had friends there who were targeted by a plane and died. I cried as I left when the regime took over. I hope its people will be able to return one day and that we will be able to go back to Ghouta. This is injustice.
So, Avril Benoit, talk about the devastation of the children. I mean, the New York Times had this major piece on children freezing to death. And then about the U.N. Secretary General's call for an immediate ceasefire, saying the risk of even greater escalation grows by the hour.
Yeah, so specifically for the children, you've seen maybe or you've heard the reports of some families having trained their children to react with giggles to the sound of bombs. I mean, these are coping mechanisms that the parents are trying to create, this bubble of safety, a sense of reassurance to children who, of course, just want to grow and play and learn. They want to be in school. We are absolutely devastated to see the condition they're in, because not only are they suffering the consequences of the direct violence, so shrapnel wounds, being trapped under collapsed buildings and so forth, there's also the problem of heating. So when you are sleeping even in a tent, for the lucky ones that actually have had access to a camp and a tent, you know, there are 1,000 camps, if not more, in Idlib province. Many of the people are trying to heat those tents in the ways that they can, suffering asphyxiation. So we've had entire family die of asphyxiation. They're using whatever fuels that they can scrounge around. And so what we've managed to do as a life-saving activity, and you wouldn't necessarily think of this as an essential thing for life, but to give them some warmth, we're transferring 300 tons of this compressed fuel for burning to so that they can warm themselves. For the kids, it's not only that, because there's also malnutrition that can be a consequence of all of this. The families don't have access to the kind of food sources that a child needs to grow, to thrive, even for their brain development. And so this is another consequence of the war, in addition to probably what you're going to see, and I'm speculating here, but the consequences over generations of the emotional trauma. You know, this can be a marker that will affect those kids in the years ahead. And for 9 years, many kids who have been displaced within Syria, not to mention the ones that managed to go to the surrounding countries like Lebanon and Turkey, is that they've not all of them have had access to school. So you've got a whole generation now that will be that much further handicapped in a way from those lack of educational opportunity.
I wanted to ask you about the potential impact of Turkey opening its borders again to refugees. Admittedly, Turkey has already suffered a huge refugee crisis as a result of this, but how that could potentially alleviate the current situation somewhat.
Yeah, Turkey has 3.5 million, if not more, Syrian asylum seekers, refugees, and of course, you know that many of them are trying to even leave Turkey. It's a very sensitive situation, and I know that the diplomatic corps is working on this at the various political levels. We'd like things to move faster. Certainly, you know, we don't have the answer to whether Turkey should let them all in, under what circumstances. We're apolitical in this. We're a humanitarian responder. But something has to change. I mean, you can't just have an area at the border where people are trapped as there's an encroaching military incursion that considers them a target for indiscriminate bombing. I mean, it's an absolutely untenable situation. And you can imagine that anyone would want to flee that area. And when all the options are closed around them, what are these people supposed to do? We're talking about millions of people.
And I want to move to the coronavirus. And there are links here. I mean, you have these crises not only in Syria, but around the world where people need to flee. And then you have countries closing their border for all sorts of reasons. But, of course, coronavirus is going to contribute to that. I wanted to turn to the issue of the coronavirus and ask you about what's happening here in the United States. New York officials say they're preparing their own test kits after kits distributed by the Centers for Disease Control failed validation tests. New cases of coronavirus continue to spring up worldwide. Nigeria is now reporting its first case. Iran's vice president testing positive, and he was next to the president. And I believe Iran has canceled prayer for the first time in like 40 years. And at the Vatican, Pope Francis canceled a planned mass after he became ill from an unknown ailment, raising jitters in Italy, where 17 people have died of coronavirus. He had been speaking about it and, you know, offering comfort to those who are suffering. How is your organization, MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, dealing with this?
We work in 70 countries, operations, medical operations projects. Those are the ones that we're focused on right now to get them ready. We have the case in Nigeria. You can imagine there are many more cases. The testing capacity in the U.S., let alone in a low-income or country or a fragile state, is extremely limiting. So we don't know where coronavirus really is, and that's one of the things that's really concerning us, because we know that those countries, their health systems are already fragile, already under-resourced. And so what we're trying to do is reinforce their capacity. We do have a team that's doing public health information, infection control, education, working out of Hong Kong, focusing also on those marginalized, vulnerable minority groups. There are little areas that you will always find or forgotten in these outbreaks where they're not part of the dominant group. The messages go out in the main language of the country and they forget about everyone else who speaks other languages. So that's our focus. The prevention is going to be big. We also have a lot of concerns, though, about the development of these testing kits. We need cheap, available, quick, you know, these rapid diagnostic kits to be available in the places where we work. Because you can imagine if coronavirus starts to infiltrate maybe one of these refugee camps or an area with a lot of internally displaced people living in crowded conditions in a stadium or in a school. We work in those kind of places providing health care. We're looking for the vaccination also. This vaccine should be affordable. There's a lot of public money going into this effort. A lot of global health experts are contributing to this effort. The profit motive of the R&D in the big pharmaceutical sector has to take into consideration that this is public money going into the development of a vaccine for coronavirus. And we would like to see the price be affordable so that those low-income countries, those countries at war, countries that don't have the means, can afford to get access to it.
I wanted to ask you about one last question. A new report by MSF, or Doctors Without Borders, it shows how migration policies imposed by the United States and Mexico have trapped thousands of Central American migrants in dangerous conditions. The report is called No Way Out. Could you talk about it? It's based on interviews about 500 migrants.
Yes, what we found in the work that we've done, and we are offering mental health care in many of the areas that are along the migration route from the different Central American countries, but also working at the border, the northern border of Mexico, as people who are trying to reach the United States and or have been sent back to the United States. What we find is that almost half of them have experienced some form of extreme violence. Watching somebody from their family be killed, being kidnapped themselves, having to deal with the violent situations of their communities, of their neighborhoods, and they have fled that. They have legitimate reasons to try to find safety. Where that safety is not really for us to say, but we can say that sending them back or making them wait in that northern area of Mexico where cartels are dominating, where cartels are exploiting them, where you've got criminal gangs that are kidnapping them and finding any which way to make money off of their presence. It's almost like the United States policy of sending the migrant protection protocols or MPP or Remain in Mexico are almost like funding these cartels in a way through in indirect form by sending these people back to be subjected to the kind of exploitation that's happening. So the suffering is real. It's a huge concern of ours. We don't have all the policy solutions. All we can say, and you know, again, we're not taking a political stance insofar as this party or this platform. What we're saying is you cannot expect people to be safe in an area that's controlled by criminal gangs with a long history of killing people. This is not the place that people who are awaiting their asylum claims should have to stay in shelters and fragile situations where they don't even dare go out during the day, let alone at night.
And then there's the great fear that President Trump, who is allay jitters because of the stock market, who's trying to say everything's okay and this is going to end in the middle of April, as if he knows, would use this, though, still as a pretext to crack down even further on desperate refugees, asylum seekers. And what would happen if, for example, coronavirus, as you were saying, in the camps and other places along the border?
It's extremely concerning to us to have colleagues arrive on flights to support the efforts on the ground in a country and find that the local authorities have made a decision to quarantine them for 14 days. Fair enough that you have to quarantine people who are at high risk, who have symptoms, and the science around this, the understanding of the risks is increasing over time. We appreciate that we all have to do our part to avoid the spread. But it's going to be very difficult, even for us. Think about it. There's a run on surgical masks right now. How are surgeons supposed to get access to masks when everyone is gobbling them up and, you know, are buying them off the shelves in every warehouse imaginable? We have patients coming in for other ailments, even into hospitals here in the U.S., but because they might have coronavirus, they're not getting the treatment they need to stay alive, dialysis or whatever else. You know, there's a delay in the quick response, the normal quick response of medical people who are fearful of coronavirus. And we also know that with infection control and all the measures that we've acquired, all that we've learned from outbreaks like the Ebola outbreak of West Africa and what we're dealing with in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo now, is that even medical teams, hospitals that you would think would know how to protect themselves, don't. So there's a huge effort that must be taken seriously in terms of protection. But if the borders start closing, if people cannot flee war, if people cannot seek health care, even if the wall in front of them is the hospital that's closed to them because they're a suspected case, you can just imagine that this coronavirus will spread even more.
And just to be clear, it's not just criminal gangs. The Mexican military, the police also brutalized Central American, Caribbean and African refugees who are coming up through the border.
There's all kinds of suffering. And you will find this also in war zones. You can imagine in Syria, you have a lot of exploitation that happens. Yes, the Syrian government and their coalition forces, including the Russian airplanes, have been a factor. You have other armed groups that have been a factor in their suffering. And then you have those who will exploit their vulnerability. I mean, these people in Idlib province who are trying to flee, they have sold everything. They had to leave everything behind. What little cash they had on them, they had to give to the truck driver that maybe piled them in to get them to safety. They have nothing left. So, any situation where we have an outbreak in a crowded area, as I said before, is going to be deeply problematic to deal with. And it'll only compound the suffering that they're experiencing.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Also, I wanted to say that the Iranian official who has tested positive for coronavirus is Masumeh Ebtekar. She is Iran's vice president for women and family affairs. Avril Benoit, our guest, Avril Benoit, is executive director of MSF USA. That's Doctors Without Borders USA. When we come back, we look at the Dominican Republic, where thousands have taken to the streets over the last week, and yesterday on Independence Day in the Dominican Republic, to protest the abrupt suspension of local elections. Stay with us. to Dust by Mazzy Star. Founding member David Roback passed away Monday at the age of 61. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Well, we turn now to the Dominican Republic, where thousands of people took to the streets of the capital, Santo Domingo, Thursday to protest the abrupt suspension of local elections earlier this month and to commemorate the country's Independence Day. Demonstrators wore black and held signs that read democracy and punishment for the corrupt. Massive protests have been ongoing since February 16th, after the government suspended the municipal elections 4 hours after voting began, alleging there were technical glitches in the electronic ballot machines that were used. Reuters reports the machines cost the Dominican government $19 million. But many Dominicans believe the alleged technical glitch is just an attempt by the ruling Dominican Liberation Party, the PLD, to hold on to power as they've lost support. This is one of the protesters in Santo Domingo Thursday.
We want to know what happened with the suspension of the municipal elections. We want answers. Young people are 40% of voters this year, and we deserve justice, as we have demanded in recent days.
Protesters are now demanding an independent investigation into what happened in the local elections, as well as for the resignation of the Dominican Election Board officials. This is Eduardo Frey, president of the Observer Commission with the Organization of American States.
The Organization of American States calls on the electoral authorities in the Dominican Republic and the political actors of the country to maintain an honest and constructive dialogue to face the next steps that should be undertaken faced with this complex reality.
That was Eduardo Frey. Municipal elections have now been rescheduled for March 15th. Meanwhile, dozens of solidarity protests have sparked Dominican communities all over the world, from Spain and France to New Jersey and right here in New York City, where thousands of people demonstrated last weekend in Washington Heights, a predominantly Dominican neighborhood. Nationwide, there are at least 1.87 million Dominicans living in the United States. Some 40% of them live here in New York City alone. For more, we're joined by Amanda Alcantara. She is digital media editor at Latino USA and also Futuro Media. She is a Dominican-American journalist and author of Chula, a bilingual collection of poems and short stories about the life of a Dominican woman before and after moving to the United States. It's great to have you with us, Amanda. If you can start off by talking about what all these protests are about, what happened with the elections in the Dominican Republic?
Yeah, so these protests are basically people taking to the streets and saying, you know, our right to democracy and our right to exercise self-determination has been taken away from us. We're talking about a country where people have been disenfranchised in many different ways. We're talking about a country that is predominantly populated by people living in poverty. And this is the one thing that they have to be able to claim, you know, any right to whatever happens to the future of their country. So imagine people standing in line for 3 to 4 hours, because that's when the elections were canceled, and being told, you now have to go home, because the elections are no longer happening. So people were angry, they were confused, and starting on that very Sunday afternoon, mostly youth started taking to the streets and going directly to La Junta Central Electoral, that's the Central Electoral Board, in Santo Domingo, to protest and to demand answers.
And, of course, the ruling party in the Dominican Republic has been in power more or less for, what, about 20 years now?
Over 18 years. So I like to talk about sort of like my own age, right? So I'm 29 years old, and they have been in power almost my entire life, you know? So, like, ever since I've had any sort of political understanding, I've only known the PLD, and that, to me, is insane.
So let's go to thousands of people who are in the streets right here in New York City, in the Dominican community in Washington Heights, to protest the suspension of the municipal elections in the Dominican Republic. This is one of the protesters, Yolis Perez.
I'm a professional who had to migrate from my country in search of a better future for my daughter. My daughter's generation needs us to truly wake up and that we clean up our country for them.
I mean, the passion of the people here as passionate of Dominicans here as they are in the Dominican Republic. Talk about the diaspora of the Dominican Republic. And also, can people vote here in for the Dominican Republic elections?
So, yes, people can vote here for the Dominican Republic elections. Sometimes, there's this sort of nickname that we have specifically for the community in New York, and that's Provincia 33, right? So sort of like the 33rd province of Dominican Republic. And, you know, I think even for me being part of the diaspora, we care so much about what's happening in the country because a lot of the issues that happen in Dominican Republic and a lot of the conditions of the people there actually lead to there being such a widespread diaspora. I mean, we're talking about Dominicans being not only in New York City, not only in different parts of, you know, the United States, but there's a large population of Dominicans in Spain. There's Dominicans all across the globe. And I think these protests are actually have become an opportunity for people to almost come out and say, hey, you know, we're Dominicans and we're also living in the exterior and we would love to live in our country, but it's difficult to live there because of these very issues that are happening, you know? And earlier you asked me about the PLD, right? So people are saying that there was attempts at fraud, you know? So whenever people went to the ballot and they tried to vote for their candidate of preference, some of the candidates were not showing up in the ballot, you know? And this is very, very questionable. It's very shady, to say the least. And people see this as an attempt at sabotage. You know, this is the first time in 18 years or the first time at least in a decade when the PLD is no longer ahead in the polls, you know, when instead is the opposition party, which is also questionable, is ahead in the polls, right? So this is the first time when the PLD might not win the elections, you know, and they found themselves in a situation of fear. And instead of, you know, allowing for the democratic process to happen, people see this as an attempt at sabotaging that democratic process.
I wanted to ask you about the attempt to redo the election. This time they're going to paper ballots because the problem, apparently, they claim was that this was an electronic voting system that somehow malfunctioned. As if we haven't heard this story before. Didn't we just hear about Iowa? Haven't we heard about all these other problems with electronic voting? Mm-hmm. So now they're going back to the old fashioned paper ballot. And then they have a presidential election in May, isn't there?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. So these elections were not only, you know, meant for people to choose their local leaders. And we know how important it is, you know, to choose the mayor that represents you, to choose the regional leader that represents you. But these ballots were also going to create momentum or were an opportunity to create momentum for the opposition come the presidential elections. Now that momentum has been lost, you know, because there is no credibility in the election process. And we have no idea what's going to happen March 15. Also, they spent $19 million on these voting machines. And people are angry about that. A lot of the signs that I have seen in protests, you know, they say these dollars, they went to the trash. How can you spend $19 million and all of that? And the machines don't work.
Like, there's been no connection between Dominican Republic and Iowa that's been uncovered, has there?
Not that we know of, but I wouldn't be surprised.
But also, Amanda, you talk about this, and Juan, you write about this in Harvest of Empire. Talk about the history of the Dominican Republic and U.S. relations there, with U.S. soldiers moving into the Dominican Republic, invading the Dominican Republic in 1965, and that how that shapes modern-day Dominican Republic.
Yeah, so, you know, there were memes popping up during the on Sunday of the face of Joaquin Balaguer. And the meme was basically him laughing and saying, wow, you don't even know how to properly steal an election, you know? So Joaquin Balaguer was the man that the United States helped put in power once there was a U.S.-backed coup in 1965. And he was president. You know, I like to talk about this a lot because I feel that Dominican Republic doesn't get I feel that people normally look at Trujillo, right? The Trujillo dictatorship that lasted 30 years, that was like a very, very tough stronghold regime where a lot of people were killed, a lot of people were disappeared. And they think, okay, after Trujillo happened, we had democracy. That's it. And that wasn't the case. Balaguer was president starting from the late 1960s up until the early 1990s. We're talking about like 2 to 3 generations of Dominicans who saw Balaguer on and off in power. And his was also a right-wing sort of strong regime and a repressive regime. And people are already seeing the connection, you know, between his time in presidency and also how long the PLD has been in power and how they have crushed the opposition. And talking about, you know, U.S. interventions, there was an article in the Washington Post that came out where Giuliani, we're talking about President Donald Trump's attorney, was in the Dominican Republic consulting for Luis Abinader, who is the opposition leader. You know, so already the other opposition parties are saying, well, this guy is trying to get U.S. backing, because in the end of the day, it is the U.S. that has a stronghold in Dominican Republic and foreign American investments that have a stronghold in the country.
Final words as we move into March 15th. Of course, this is something we will cover, and whether you feel the government will hold fair elections.
I think the government has no other choice but to hold fair elections. I think that if they don't, the people will no longer accept, not having fair elections, right? So I've been thinking about, you know, what does it mean for people to be taking the streets to today, for people to be taking the streets in historic numbers, and whether this can cause change or not, you know? And I don't think that institutional change is going to happen from one day to the next, but I do think that the people now know that these elected officials are accountable to you. You know, so if on March 15, we don't really know what's going to happen, but if the elections are not fair and if they're not transparent, which is what the people are demanding, I think the protests are just going to continue.
Well, we'll continue to cover those as well. Amanda Alcantara, digital media editor at Latino USA, Dominican-American journalist, author of Chula, a bilingual collection of poems and short stories about the life of a Dominican woman before and after moving to the United States. When we come back, we look at the fight to save a New Jersey elementary school that serves a large Latino community in New Brunswick, New Jersey, from the forces of a healthcare industry and gentrification. Stay with us.
El costo de la vida sube otra vez.
El peso que baja ya ni se ve.
Y las habichuelas no se pueden comer.
Una libra de arroz, una cuarta de café.
A nadie le importa qué piensa usted.
Será porque aquí
no hablamos inglés.
Ah, ah,
es verdad.
Ah, ah,
es verdad.
Ah, ah,
es verdad.
Do you
understand?
Usted.
No hablamos francés.
Ah, ah.
Bupale.
Ah, ah.
Bupale.
Ah, ah.
Bupale.
Ah, ah.
No me sié. Somos un agujero en medio del mar y el cielo.
The Cost of Life by the Dominican musician Juan Luis Guerra. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We end today's show in New Jersey, where hundreds rallied at the New Brunswick Board of Education meeting Tuesday night, protesting to plans to demolish a public school to make way for a Robert Wood Johnson Hospital and Rutgers University to build a new cancer center. Protesters included families and more than 30 children who held signs reading "Save Our School" and "Stop Gentrification." If approved, 760 third through eighth graders at Lincoln Annex School would be moved to a former warehouse building converted into a school on the outskirts of town as they await construction of a replacement school. Even worse, the proposed replacement school site is located on a brownfield site with possible contamination from hazardous chemicals. This is one of the parents at Tuesday night's school board meeting.
Since September, we have been in this fight. We don't want our schools up for sale. It's our school, it's our kids, it's our community. And if we want to leave New Brunswick or for our kids to go to school far outside the city, we want it to be of our own accord, not because we are being pushed out. Our dignity, our school, is not for sale.
Organizer Sherry Wolf with the local Rutgers Professors Union blasted the plan as racist gentrification.
We understand that the students of New Brunswick are our future students.
Yes.
We have skin in this game.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We pay taxes here.
Yes.
We live and work here.
Yes.
And at levels much higher than the rest of the American population, we vote here.
Yes.
And I am going to make you a promise. We will do everything in our power as a union. We are well-resourced to help organize politically and on the ground the community in solidarity to stop this destruction of a thriving school, to stop the racist displacement of a Latino community under the pretext of a cancer institute. We have no beef with a cancer institute. We do have a beef with racism. We do have a beef with gentrification. We do have a beef with lying. We do have a beef with people saying they are doing something in the best interests of children and then ignoring the children and their families. And the performance earlier of throwing people out who simply want to speak is precisely the kind of arrogance that is going to win you even greater opposition.
That's Rutgers organizer Sherry Wolf. After closing off the public comment at Tuesday's New Brunswick School Board meeting, members of the board went into a closed session after much of the public had left. They came back into public session and voted to begin the process of closing down the Lincoln Annex School, the New Brunswick Elementary School, and moving forward with their plan. Juan, you've been deeply involved with this story. Can you talk more about it?
Yeah, Amy, I think what's important to understand is that this is a community battle that really has national implications, because all over America, in lots of urban areas, there are healthcare institutions or universities, whether it's the University of Chicago or Columbia or NYU or Johns Hopkins, all these universities and these health institutions located down in downtown areas are always seeking to expand and to grab more land and more territory. And in this particular case, this is a David and Goliath battle that has erupted, and it's going to get even bigger in the weeks to come. And it just erupted in the last few weeks, where you have a poor immigrant community. The city of New Brunswick has 50,000 people. Half of them are Latino, most of them Mexican immigrants. And they occupy the downtown area of New Brunswick, right in around Rutgers University and the healthcare industry. Robert Wood Johnson Hospital, the St. Peter's Hospital. There are all of these hospitals and healthcare institutions right around the and of course, it's New Brunswick is the corporate headquarters of Johnson & Johnson, which is also downtown. And so last summer, suddenly Robert Wood Johnson and Rutgers announced that they're going to build a new $750 million expansion, a new standalone cancer center. But they didn't say where they were going to build it. They announced it in June. And the president of the New Jersey Senate was there, that the president of the assembly, all the political forces of New Jersey made this grand announcement. Then only a couple of weeks ago, after parents kept saying, hey, our school is across the street from the hospital. Are you going to take our school? And they kept saying, no, no, those are only rumors. It's not going to happen. Suddenly, the mayor came out with an announcement saying, yes, the hospital wants to buy the Lincoln Annex School, 750 children, 94% of them Latino.
It's really a center of the Latino community.
Right, and it's the best performing school in the city of New Brunswick. And it's a school that the city just spent $22 million to renovate and reopen a few years ago. So it's only been open for 3.5 years now. And now they want to sell it to Robert Wood Johnson, close it down, send the kids a couple of miles away to a converted warehouse on the outskirts of town for several years while they wait for a new school to be built. And, of course, the site for the replacement school, as we mentioned in the lead, is on a contaminated brownfield site. So the parents started organizing, and they said, what are you doing? You know, we love our school. We don't find another place to build your hospital expansion. And they've been marching in the streets. There have been protests in downtown New Brunswick. They've been appearing at Rutgers Board of Governors meetings. They've been appearing at the Board of Education. No one is listening. So what's happened increasingly now is that the entire Rutgers University community, which is how I got involved, the faculty are behind this, the parents, all of the student organizations, the Muslim students, the Mexican students, the NAACP chapter of Rutgers, all of them are behind the parents, and they're going to continue this fight to insist that the healthcare industry find another place to build this hospital.
And yet the school board voted to sell the school.
And the school board is
not
listening.
So what happens next?
Well, what happens next is that they're going to continue to fight because it's not done yet. The Latino Justice, the civil rights group has gotten involved. There are going to be lawsuits, and there are going to be even more escalating protests over the next few days.
Well, Rutgers University Professor Juan Gonzalez, thank you so much for that analysis. And, of course, Democracy Now! Co-host. That does it for our show. Tune in Tuesday. Tuesday night for Democracy Now! Super Tuesday live special broadcast with The Intercept from 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to midnight, right here at democracynow.org and on many stations around the country. We have a number of positions that we are hiring for in our newsroom, outreach and development teams, information application deadlines at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, Tamari Studio, Adriana Contreras. I'm Amy Goodman-Gonzalez.